Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Don Farmer and Chris Curl. Don and Chris are veterans of TV news. They will be discussing about their lives in the news industry and their award-winning novel, Deadly News. Good morning, Don and Chris. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having us on. It's such a pleasure. We know you have so many listeners and you have had so many interesting guests. We're just so pleased to be among them.
Hi, good morning.
I am excited to have both of you on the air. I'm a little bit intimidated here on this side of the equation.
I don't think you should worry about that. I mean, if you're an expert ballroom dancer, as you are, and teacher of ballroom dancing, that's, talk about intimidating. I mean, how many people do you know who would go out there and do that? I'm not kidding. I can't. I would. Some people are afraid of public speaking. Some people are afraid of going outside the door. Some people have all kinds of personal difficulties or challenges.
Yeah.
But to me, ballroom dancing would be in the top five.
First, you have to be in very good shape, don't you? I mean, you have to be able to, you have to really be in good physical shape to do that.
Yes, I really enjoyed that. As a matter of fact, that is a form of exercise that you don't really go out there and pump iron to be fit.
Well, first of all, you can't go out there wearing just gym shorts and a tank top either. Ballroom dancers don't do that, do they?
No. But, I mean, when we were working out or something like that. But it's been fun. It's been very, very exciting. And I have a wonderful partner. And we are actually doing so many different things now. And one of the things we're doing also, we're teaching kids cotillion, introduction to cotillion ballroom dancing.
That must be amusing as well as satisfying, hmm?
It is. I think it's just a wonderful thing to introduce to kids at a very young age to have that proper manners. Those things are gone. It's kind of, it's just wonderful to bring it back again. And that brings us back to you guys. I mean, you all are veterans in the TV news. You all have seen a span of things that have happened over the last, certainly, 30, 40 years. And it's been fascinating.
At least, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful life. I really enjoyed reading your book. It's very exciting. Deadly News, I thought, has a wonderful title that just captivates you. It is an entertaining read, great insights on how the news industry works. And although the book is a thriller, it is very much a funny book. It has a lot of funny moments in it. It's about real life. It's so surreal. I think that's the difference. Those are the value-added information in the book that I thought was wonderful because written by people that actually are in the industry itself. The insight look behind the scenes, so to speak. So congratulations.
That's our best review yet, isn't it, Don?
Yeah, we're going to record this review and send it to the papers. We have been blessed with very nice comments and reviews and critiques by a lot of people in the business. And that's kind of nice when somebody like Katie Couric or Greta Van Susteren or Neil Bortz or
Clark Howard
or all these other veteran radio stars and television stars, when they say this is realistic, even though it's a novel, that really, I guess credibility is everything. You know? I hope so, anyway.
In so many ways, it's kind of lack at this time in the news industry, to be precise. I mean, I just happened to see something on PBS the other day about how Walter Cronkite raced to fame in the sense of making sure that, well, let's check and verify and so forth before we put it on the air. And then, of course, now is let's put it on the air and check later.
That's for sure. The speed of communications, news media, has increased more fold than I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
But the quality has not. It's not kept up. The race has been won by, as you say, get it on the air and then we'll sort it out. You know?
Right.
And I don't mean to be cynical, and I don't mean to sound just like an old guy shouting at the kids to get off my lawn, that kind of thing. But it is true, and one of the reasons is because of the technology, and our book addresses this in some amusing ways, because of the technology now, you can actually do a live TV on-air report from your iPhone in Borneo or someplace, you know, some remote place that doesn't even have a cell
anywhere
phone.
Anywhere you've got bars, you can be a reporter.
Or a satellite version of the same, that's right. That does is, Johnny, and I'm sure you touched on it first here, when you have the capability to start talking before you know what you're talking about, you tend to do that because you're getting pressured back in the studio from the boss and let's get it on the air. And the luxury of being able to study a story a little while, to study a series of facts and to ask the next question and the next question, that is we're losing that battle. And that's too bad.
Johnny, you said a moment ago that now it's the opposite. You report things before you really know what you're saying. I think especially now with all the 24-hour all-news cable news channels, sometimes they'll get video from, let's just say, California. And they'll get the video of something happening at some school or something somewhere. And they'll take the video and they'll say, we are getting these pictures from California. It looks like a fire. Oh, no, it's not a fire. We'll get right back to you when we find out what it is. They actually put the video on the air and are supposed to talk about it without even really knowing what town it came from yet. You know, I mean, that's just that the technology is driving that kind of irresponsibility.
And as you know, from having read my book, Deadly News, it's part of the narrative is about the reporters and the producers, and not just them, but also the public relations people who really don't care about whether it's real. They just want to get it on the air first and say we were first.
That's
so
correct.
You get to see some inside stuff that we just know because we've done it forever.
Right.
And we've changed the names to protect the guilty. So, you know.
Very interesting. Very interesting insight. Let's get back to you guys. We know people through, like I say, in this case, you guys, we see you on the air, and of course, whether it's regionally or nationally, and I remembered seeing you in the early 80s, I believe, when CNN first started out in Take Two.
Yeah, from day one.
I didn't realize that you guys are married, obviously. But what's interesting about it is that we want to know how you guys grew up and some of the childhood moments that kind of really speaks to you in terms of, I guess, channeling you to who you are today.
Yeah.
Well, Don and I got married. I'll start there. We got married in Texas, as a matter of fact, in Houston. And we met in Houston where I was working. I was the first girl in the newsroom. It was that far back when we were still girls. And I was sort of a catch-all receptionist, follow people around and go for do what need to be done, which was great training because I got to do, and it was non-union, so I got to do all kinds of things that I never would have gotten to do otherwise. So it was a great learning experience. I met Don because he was there covering stories for ABC when he was the bureau chief, the Southern bureau chief. But I got to Houston because my family, I was born in Denver and my family moved to California and then they moved to Texas. And that we didn't move around a lot, but there were a few moves, luckily to really nice places to live. But I always was interested in what was going on around me, and I was always like on the school newspaper, like in elementary school, it was the Hunting Horn was the name of our little newspaper, and it writes stupid little things. But I remember how much fun it was to see a byline.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's just vanity or whether I was, you know, happy to be imparting some information that other kids would find interesting about whatever was going on in school that day. But it was fun. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the actual writing of it. So I guess that would be my big start, was at the Hunting Horn in elementary school.
My first touch with journalism in its most fundamental in least impressive form was when a sophomore in high school, the teacher, I think it was a sociology class maybe, made us write essays on what we want to be when we grow up. Being sophomores, they know we hadn't grown up yet.
And so
I had no idea. And so I just, for some reason, I thought about electrician, electric. So I said, I want to be an electrical engineer. And I wrote this essay. He turned in the essay, and at the end of the class, he collected the papers and looked at them and called me in after the class was over and said, you know, you wrote this essay about being an electrical engineer. You don't know a darn thing about that, do you? And I said, no, I don't. He said, well, but you wrote it very well. Why don't you just be a writer? This is true.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so from there, I thought, well, that's certainly easier than trying to put wires together that may blow myself up doing it. So I sort of, my first writing for money, I think it was 50 cents an hour, really, was covering the high school wrestling team for the local weekly paper in a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up. And to this day, I can't watch an amateur wrestling match, as good as they are. I just had enough. You know? And then, it went on from there. I was lucky to live in Missouri because the University of Missouri, a state university, has and had a good journalism curriculum. And so I could go to school there for a very low price because it was a state school.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't have afforded to go to Northwestern or Columbia or someplace like that. So I was able to get a good education at a good journalism school, part of the University of Missouri system. And it went on from there. One thing I'll tell you, this is important to youngsters coming up, maybe. Working at summers for the St. Louis Globe Democrat, and my assignment was from 6 p.m. to 2:30 in the morning was to cover the morgue. in downtown St. Louis. Every night I'd go to work at 6 o'clock, and I'd go look at dead bodies until 2:30 in the morning, and then I'd write about whatever any of them were important enough to put in the paper, and then I would go home and think, what am I doing? And my dad would say, well, what'd you do last night? And I said, well, there was a shooting here and a robbery there, and He's my father was frowning at me and saying, I'm sure he must have been thinking, why didn't you just become an electrical engineer? So I was working for the newspaper, and then I got a chance to work in television back at the University of Missouri, owned an NBC station. Anyway, so I decided I liked television better. And I went to the editor of the Globe Democrat, a wonderful mentor named George Killenberg. And I said, sir, I need to leave now because I have a job in TV at this station in central Missouri. And he said, television? Television news? That's an oxymoron. They don't do news. They just open up the morning paper and get that. And he said, Don, if you go to television, you know what you'll be doing? I said, what, sir? And he said, you'll be writing on sand. And I thought, ooh. But I like the beach. So I went ahead and went into television anyway. And from there, I went on up and did other things. And some of it's in the book and some in the book called Camouflage, too. So there you go.
I understand. Well, let me ask you guys this. Are y'all pretty much passion-driven in trying to find the truth in the way when y'all were working? Or was it driven pretty much by stories? You guys don't have much of a choice. Like, this is a job. Somebody's got to cover it. And I'm out there to cover it.
I think for me, it was the storytelling. I'm passionate. No, not really. I liked it a lot, and I never could get over the thrill of literally, truthfully being able to go all around the world several times.
Yeah.
And find out stuff that nobody else knows about, and then come home and get paid to tell everybody. I mean, it's just the best thrill for me because I was seeing the wonders of the world on ABC News' nickel or CNN's dime.
Right.
And my job was to go find out stuff and then tell everybody else. Well, how can that not be fun?
You
bring up a good. You've obviously been around television and media for a long time yourself because if you are, for example, a general assignment reporter. And, somewhere in Dallas or somewhere in Texas, something happens and you have to go cover it. Now, if it's a really interesting, unique story, then that's like, picking up a great book to read. But if it's just another 7-Eleven robbery or it's an accident or something, not that they aren't bad, but you've done 150 accidents, there's got to be some similarity between them or among them. That is a challenge. Yes, you want to tell the truth, but it really isn't so much a matter of digging out the truth. It's a matter of telling the story accurately. Mm-hmm. And I guess you just have to approach it, well, this story, it's my 150th accident, but, hey, it's the first accident for the people involved in it. I'm going to tell this story so that it at least is respectful to everybody involved and to the viewer because you have to remember that there's someone out there listening to you do your radio program and for us to do a report or some some reporter. So you have to do it the best you can, even if you think it's boring or not interesting, and you're waiting for that big break.
And in terms in terms of the skill or the talent idea of what you do for a living, what someone does for a living, I preferred writing to broadcasting. I didn't mind broadcasting. I made a living at it, but being on television was never my primary goal. I put it this way, and this is self-serving, but that's okay. Just briefly, some people in the TV news business are journalists who do television,
right?
And some people are television people who do journalism, and I know you can tell the difference there because of the emphasis.
Yeah,
you see, I was primarily a journalist who happened to be able to do television well enough for somebody to pay me to do it, and that was good and fun and exciting. But at heart, I really much preferred to sit down and write the stories and write the documentary. You know, and as Chris was talking about the tedium sometimes of the business, the same kind of stories over. If you had to interview us every day for the next 6 months, sort of like Groundhog Day, the movie. You would lose your mind. You know, you would be looking for some place to get rid of us because it may have been interesting the first time. I hope maybe the second time on a slow day, but after that, you don't want to hear that story about that electrical engineering thing ever again in the history of your life. So that's the point. So part of it, you just get tired of it too, and you have to move on.
That's interesting. I just find that when reporters are natural, whether they are anchormen or anchorwomen, or like you say, journalists themselves, when they find a connection with the story that they're covering, it has a truly different delivery, you know, message that you have. And then, of course, I'm sure like everything else, you need to practice a certain amount of restraint, a disconnection there where, hey, just the facts and not get personal and not get emotional about this. And I really don't know whether that's good or bad, I guess, in the news industry.
You know, it's good, but unfortunately, it's good, I think. But unfortunately, so is the buggy whip, you know. So was Betamax cassettes. It's changing, and it has changed. And most of the journalism we get in television today is opinion journalism or analysis journalism or whatever you want to call it. It's not totally objective. Now, being fair and being objective are different, but they're both difficult. How can you remove your emotions, your own life experiences? How can you not relate to a child who's injured in an accident or something and you're reporting?
Right.
How can you not relate to that? You know, but you have to be careful, because if you relate to it too much, you change the story just by being part of it, and that's that ruins the story. In other words, it ruins the communicative part of what you're trying to do.
Because people know what they think and what they feel, and if there's something happens to a child. There was an editor once a long time ago for a famous magazine, and he told one of his reporters, don't say this is tragic. Don't say this is sad. Don't tell the viewer or the reader what it is, because they're smart. They can figure it out. And if you're crying, they're not.
And
the point is, if the reporter is oh, this is so sad, then the reader or the viewer is just going, oh, that guy's so sad, but oh well, this is, you know, they're all once removed. But if the reporter says, now here's this, tells the story what happened, then the viewer or the reader can go, oh my gosh, that's just horrible, and they're feeling it because they've got the facts, they can process what happened, and then they get to their feelings. And that's the way you want to report. You don't want to report like a cold fish, like you don't care. But there's this funny story that goes way back to when Barbara Walters, before she became an anchorwoman, and she was you know, the famous interviewing person, and she was interviewing the Shah of Iran before he was deposed. And he was being gracious and asking about her, and the interview was going on, and she said famously, well, sir, enough about me, what do you think of me? those weren't the exact words, but it's just been kind of a mantra for you know, for us and for other reporters. It's just, don't make it all about you. You know, you do have a story to tell.
Very interesting. Very, very, very interesting. What life's epiphanies over the years, in the broadcasting years, I guess, in some ways, because you guys have an opportunity to really flavor the world in terms of news and experiences that are kind of unique that not many of us, if any of us, have the first-hand opportunity to really experience. What are those life epiphanies that help to shape you to be the person you are today?
I think mine, without question, the dominant one, mm-hmm. that it was a life-changing experience, mm-hmm. truly, was my assignment in the mid-60s and then on through the decade and into the early 70s to cover the civil rights movement in the United States, which mm-hmm. which has several starting points, but one of those was the Selma, Alabama bridge
yeah.
incident, and another was Dr. King's going to jail. And I had a chance in the mid-60s to cover Dr. King and to meet him and to sit and talk with him at length occasionally and to see, to really understand that movement. And growing
yeah.
up as a kid in a mostly white suburb of St. Louis, I never had any racial animus toward anybody, but I never had any much racial, interracial experiences either.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of just this unconscious guy just there covering the story because it's a story. But after a while, I started to get it, and I started to realize how historic this was. And that really changed my life in terms of didn't make me a better person. It didn't make me a less prejudiced or more prejudiced. That wasn't it. It was
yeah.
just the impact is so enormous. And mm-hmm. and I realized, for example, for the first time in my maybe badly educated youth, what an impact slavery as an institution
yeah.
still has in this country. And I don't mean there's slavery. I don't mean that, and I'm not getting into that stuff. I'm not.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But it's just certain things would last for centuries.
Yeah.
And I was lucky to be part of a minor part, just an ABC News correspondent, mm-hmm. trying to find out what's going on and then tell everybody. It was a life-changing experience for me. And I think that probably would make everything else, and I've had a few of those, like the first time mm-hmm. I ever got shot at and almost hit but didn't.
Wow.
Those things tend to get your attention.
right.
But the mind, thank goodness, tends to blot out the worst of our past, I think,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and allow us to revel in the best of our present and, with any luck, our future.
Mm-hmm.
But meantime, Dr. King was probably the most interesting, profoundly interesting person I'd ever mm-hmm. met on any sort of personal level. And so that would be it for me, yeah.
Very interesting.
For me, I think going to, after Don and I got married and we lived in London, mm-hmm. and one of his assignments was to fill in for some of the other correspondents who were, mm-hmm. for example, based in Rome mm-hmm. or in some of the other bureaus, Germany, et cetera. And
mm-hmm.
One summer, we were in Israel for about 2 months, and I had never been in the Middle East at all, and that's a whole different exposure than like going to Europe or going to other places where people usually go on vacation, and
mm-hmm.
it really had an impact on me. I mean, you talk about the centuries of problems from slavery in this country and other sort of social economic
yeah.
problems.
Yeah.
Boy, that goes back and not just centuries, but millennia. And
right.
So that for me, not just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict really drew it home for me, but also just that so much of all of our history goes back to that
yeah.
one tiny little region,
right.
Just the little spot. So it was not that I didn't know generally the history, but it was a
mm-hmm.
huge detailed history lesson, and watching how the people of today are dealing with all the events of the past over,
right.
Decades, millennia, it's just really, really interesting to me. And, of course, it makes it so much easier now to understand why, peace talk after peace talk, fail, and
right.
there isn't hope. But,
right.
It's just so complicated. But that, for me, was a real sort of a turning point in my sort of understanding of the worldview.
Sure. Very interesting. What I've heard from both of you is that there is a point in time in your professional lives. What started out as a job, it's fun, it's exciting. This is the new news media, whether it's broadcast, TV, and so forth. That job became a career because there's a passion-driven thing from within that changes y'all from inside out in so many ways.
I guess that's true, but I guess maybe it's not only true but important. Your point mm-hmm. is important because some people, maybe it was just me when I was young, the thought of a career was somebody who did ballroom dancing for a living, for example, or was an actor in the movies. That's a career. Somebody yeah. Who works in an office, let's yeah. say, you know, a personal assistant to somebody or a mid-level executive, that's a job.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
that's obviously neither of those things is exclusively true.
I think if you say, I would like to do something,
yeah.
I want to make this my career, you don't really make it a career until it kind of grabs you.
That's right.
You
yeah.
know, and I think at some point if somebody says to, let's say somebody who is really good at marketing, and that
yeah.
person works for a big company, and then another company comes along and says, well, you know, come work for us, that person follows the skills that he or she has, like being a great marketer.
Right.
So the career, I guess, would be marketing, but you can take those skills to a lot of different employers. I suppose it's the same in ours because we did work for different news outfits, but in terms of
right.
the actual what do you do to do your job, I can't think, there never was a point when I thought, well, I've got to do something else with my life. This is,
yeah.
you know, I'm not doing this another day. I never...
Right.
It was the opposite. I was thinking, you know, I'm so lucky and so happy to be, you know, able to do what I'm doing because I, you know, I love it, whether I'm doing it for CNN
yeah.
or doing it for an ABC station in Atlanta or
right.
in Houston or
yeah.
Washington, and I guess, Don, the same with
yeah.
ABC or
yeah. yeah
or CNN.
Yeah. One of the things that I learned in doing this book, which mm-hmm. relates directly to this point, I think, your
right.
point about
yeah.
a career,
yeah.
is
yeah.
we as part of the novel writing effort,
yeah.
you find yourself having to do backstories or fill in the blanks on a character.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the character, as you know this, the protagonist and the antagonist
yeah,
will become
yeah,
wooden
yeah.
and two-dimensional and therefore boring. And
yeah.
boring is the one thing you have to avoid.
You didn't want Deadly News to be boring, did you?
Didn't want
there you go.
Deadly. We didn't want Deadly to mean deadly boring.
Yeah.
Deadly boring. Anyway, what I learned was in writing backstories, we
yeah.
created the characters, and then as going along, we say, well, now, this one character is a very strong, very talented mm-hmm. female investigative reporter
mm-hmm.
and named Cassie. And we call her Cassie. She's a good friend of ours. We wanted to put her in a place because she's African American,
mm-hmm.
and we wanted to put her in give her a background. And well, she's African American in love with an Irish American police detective named Jimmy,
mm-hmm.
and he's our friend too. And explaining their relationship.
No, not in real life. They're both
no.
made up.
But in explaining their relationship, these characters in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to make it clear, I won't spoil it, but to give the reader an understanding of how and why they got together, and immediately your idea is, well, is it racial? You know, is there a racial component
right.
to this thing? We wanted,
yeah.
we didn't want that to be the focus. We wanted it to be the kinds of people they were, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Character, not color.
Right.
So what we did was we created a scenario for her in which her upbringing, although as an African American in an integrated community, that obviously is an issue for anybody. I mean, not a,
mm-hmm.
necessarily a
well,
bad issue, but
we've had her in
yeah.
Galveston, in Texas.
So we put her in Galveston, Texas,
mm-hmm.
working
mm-hmm.
in a restaurant owned by her dad,
mm-hmm.
and so she was there doing everything from cleaning the grease pits to waiting tables and charming
mm-hmm.
the customers, and we gave her a background which made her sort of consider race
mm-hmm.
as the fourth or fifth most important thing in her life,
right?
And not the
right.
most important thing. And I'm just saying that's one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And and then so when she came up and was doing what she was doing in the rest of this story, it made the people have an understanding of what makes this woman tick,
right?
You know, and how she approaches. Cover in her career, how she approaches her job of doing investigative reporting.
In fact, one person read the book and said that he didn't realize that she was African American until about halfway through the book,
mm-hmm.
when
mm-hmm.
there is some, she's having some sort of a discussion with her boyfriend, and it kind of, if you didn't get it before, it sort of comes
yeah.
out then. So there's no politics in the book at all, And mm-hmm. there's no, even though she's African-American and he's Irish-American, it's irrelevant. We only did that
just because
real life is filled with different kinds of people. And we wanted to make sure that the book, you know, when Don started writing, that it reflected, you know, real life, that there are different kinds of people who meet in different kinds of situations and, you know, make do with what they have and move forward.
Some of the characters in Deadly News are just unbelievable, but real. I mean, real. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Well, maybe the most outrageous is a character who she's a youngish, shy producer, a TV producing mm-hmm. producing newscasts on a TV station in Atlanta in this particular
mm-hmm.
case.
Mm-hmm.
But she has very bad personal habits. For example, she'll eat at her desk and at her computer on a computer desk in
mm-hmm.
the newsroom. She'll eat popcorn or candy or chew gum or drink Cokes and stuff. And she was very sloppy about it. And
mm-hmm.
we used to drive everybody else crazy in the newsroom because if she sat down at their desk, like the night shift, they use the same desk, you know, they come
right.
in. Well, Rita's been here. You know, there are 400, there's four bags of popcorn shells on the floor, peanut shells. Anyway, and she was really obnoxious. And she also was one of these people who went on flights of fantasy. She decided mm-hmm. that she decided at one point that she was of Native American heritage,
mm-hmm.
and that was questioned.
Now, at the moment, Don is talking about the character in the book.
Right,
now, that
right,
part's
right.
made up, but there actually
yeah.
was
yeah.
a person in our experience, a producer
mm-hmm.
who was did
mm-hmm.
leave a little debris pit wherever she sat, and that part is true. But this other character that Don's discussing
yeah,
was
and, you know,
drawn upon her,
and it really doesn't
yeah.
matter about
yeah.
that other point. The yeah. point is that she not only left a debris pit, but she also it was stuck and sticks to her clothing. And, oh, the funniest
yeah.
part was, I think, was mm-hmm. that once in a while, on a, as you know, on a computer keyboard,
right.
if you could drop, let's say you dropped a little salt. And it fell
apple juice.
Yeah,
it goes right into
Coke.
the keyboard.
It'll
yeah.
stick the keys together, you know. So we arranged it in the book so that she had every time she tried to type this, it came out this, and I won't ruin it for you, but it was just very funny. and we used to drive the other people who had to use that computer the next shift. Drive
right.
crazy. So those kinds of things just really add spice to the book and some humor to the book, and
mm-hmm.
I guess the reason we like it so much is because it's real. We didn't
mm-hmm.
make that up.
Yeah, and we're not trying to, we don't point fingers at anybody or try to hurt anybody.
Right,
it's an affectionate
right.
look at the people who populate the news business. And
yeah.
we were, it's, you know, the whole book, as you know, since
yeah.
you read it, Donnie, and we appreciate that it's set in Atlanta, it's set in Southwest Florida, and it's set in
mm-hmm.
London. But basically it could take place in every or any TV newsroom around the country.
That's
I mean,
correct.
If it's not this goofy person, it's another goofy person. If it's not this
right.
situation, it's another one, because they're all, you know, pretty much run the same. The hierarchy is pretty much the same. The relationship
right.
between the anchor people and the reporters, the anchor people with each other, the
yeah.
reporters with management. I mean, all of those dynamics are pretty much the same in any newsroom anywhere. And so we were trying to reflect that a little bit so that people,
right.
as you said, when you introduced us, do kind of see what happens when the reporter puts down his microphone or her microphone and says, you know, back to you in the studio. You kind of have an idea of what he's saying out there.
right, right.
because
right.
he wasn't happy with his report or them, and then the anchor people are fighting for the last word and, you know, just kind of
mm-hmm.
those funny scenarios.
It's true, because you covered pretty much real-life situation. Like you were saying, the templates are pretty much the same, no matter how big or small. You have the hierarchy, and you have certain people within that group that pretty much have to behave the same way it is, because that's the nature of the industry. And that leads me to the next question, in the sense of, how competitive is it to climb up to be a news anchor?
Well, I put it this way. I use the baseball analogy. I love baseball, and in a Major League Baseball, there are 30 teams, and on any given day during the season, with some, you know, occasional exceptions for
yeah.
unusual circumstances, there are 25 men who are active on the active roster, right?
Yeah.
The team has 25 players who can go in the field and play the game, who are allowed to, you know. And so if you take 25 times 30 teams,
mm-hmm.
I think that's somewhere around 750 or something like that. But anyway, so there's about in all of Major League Baseball, there are only 750 people at any given time who are theoretically good enough to play Major League Baseball, and we all know how good you have to be at that game to play it at that level.
Well,
let's look at TV news. Leave out the networks because that's a different character, and we've done both, so we know both. But if you take all, if you take the top 10 or the top 20, the top 10 largest TV markets in the country, New York, L.A., Chicago, Dallas, Atlanta, whatever, and you figure that in a major market like those cities, you have at least three and usually four and sometimes five in L.A. and in New York, TV stations that do news every day on the air. So let's suppose, I won't go through the whole math, but the point is when you take all of those people and you say, okay, you got three anchors in the morning and two and blah, 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 and you put those numbers together, what you come up with are fewer than 750 people, I can't remember the number, but it's much fewer than that, who are good enough to be a major news anchor in the United States on this particular moment in time.
Right.
Well, that's pretty impressive if you figure baseball and knowing what that skill level is, TV news anchoring, I'm not saying they have to be that skilled, but the point I try to make is that it's the air is rare.
And so
you made the point that doesn't, I mean, the fact that they have those jobs doesn't mean that they're great people or that they really have the best skills in the world. They got there somehow or another. How each anchor got there is a unique story of his or her own. You know, it may have to do with race, it may have to do with gender, it may have to do with being terrific or being the right person at the right time or, you know, the nephew of the owner, you know.
Remember Dan Rather, the late, not late, but the late, recently unemployed. Dan Rather, he was a reporter in Houston, and he made his bones, so to speak, during a hurricane when he went out and strapped himself to a telephone pole or a bus stop
or a palm tree.
Stood there wrapped around this palm tree and did this report, and nobody had ever done that before. Now, every time it sprinkles, reporters go out and try to find a puddle to stand in. You know.
Also, the funny thing about that story is if you're a viewer, you know, or a television executive in New York looking at this brave reporter, and you're looking at the video of this person strapped to a telephone pole or something, reporting into the microphone and looking into the camera. Into the camera, which is being held by a photographer,
who I presume
is not strapped to a tree. So I would not hire Rather; I'd hire the photographer.
There you go.
I was covering the Yom Kippur War in Israel.
Yeah, right.
Israel against Syria and Egypt in 1972 and three and four, and I won't say his name because he threatened to sue me if I ever did. But there was a reporter for a major TV station in the Northeast who was there covering for his TV station. He's well known now, this guy. And he was. We were up in the Golan Heights area, which was what used to be Syrian-occupied territory, and now is Israeli-occupied territory. It's part of the results of that war, which the Israel won against Syria and Egypt. Anyway, the point is that this guy was up there, and he was crouched down on the side of the road. And off in the background, here's what you see on TV. Off in the background, you could see poof, poof, the artillery shells exploding, but way, way off. And you could, anybody who'd ever been there more than once would know that they were maybe a mile away or three-quarters of a mile away or whatever the visual line would be. But they weren't very close. So he's crouched down there and saying, oh, they're getting closer. So he all of a sudden he says, we got to get out of here now. So he jumps up. He scrambles up the side of this gravelly sort of road, and he scrambles up there, and he runs over to a white car sitting on the side of the road and gets in the car. His driver's in the car, and he gets in the car, and he says, let's go, get out of here, and they zoom off. Now, this is what you see on TV. You see all of this. He goes, jumps in the car, and he drives away. And his script says, the reason you see there's a camera standing right there, and he didn't go anywhere. The whole thing was bogus. I mean, it was just horrible, and that's the kind of thing that the worst among us in this business do. The best among us don't do that.
Yeah, and that's why I brought that up, because I think there is a point in time at, you know, what is real and what's not, and are you being authentic, because you guys, whether you like it or not, you have a fiduciary responsibility to be accurate, to be honest, and to be accountable. And so your action speaks that on all three categories. And so that's a lot of load to carry. And so how you carry yourself is going to be very important. And
well, what you do is eventually you retire from daily television and you write a novel and you can make stuff up. And that's really fun.
Yeah.
There you go. So that's the inspiration behind the book.
That's
inspiration right there, you see. So, you know, that's why Deadly News is the way it is. And I'm glad that you guys put it in the book in the sense of, you know, these are snapshots of reality. And then you talk about the human factor, because we all are driven differently from our self-fulfilling things that we want to accomplish in life. Yeah. Were there challenges in writing the book?
Well, challenges... Yeah, but it's the kind of challenge like, you know, the hardest thing is the first line and the last line of the first chapter and the last chapter.
Yeah.
The challenge is, that really is true in some ways. The challenge is to get at it and sit down and do it. But once you get into it, sometimes you can't stop and you write some of the silliest stuff at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
and you have to go back the next day and change it, but you're on a roll. So I think it's sort of like a bad driver who keeps hitting the accelerator and the brake. you can get nauseous, car sick when they do that, right?
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
I have to, this is a caveat, the book, if you look at the book you got there, Johnny, you can see that the Don Farmer, by Don Farmer, that font is really big, and then it says, with Chris Curl down at the bottom. So that's because actually Don wrote the book. I'm the backup singer. I did a lot of editing and, you know, a lot of research, and, you know, we discussed character development, and we had fun with the backstories and stuff. But after we'd have our little discussions, then Don would go back and, I mean, he wrote the book. I was his backup singer, like I say, so.
Yeah, it's sort of like in one of your several professions, Johnny. you just come off the stage after a brilliant ballroom dancing performance, and your wife or your partner or your coworker or whomever whispers in your ear, "You really blew it on that far turn over there by the light. Don't do that again." I write something, and Chris would say, "Don, nobody talks that way."
There you go.
Well, or we'd say this, you know, this, I don't know, we just discuss it, and then and that's kind of the fun thing, is that it's not like writing a report where, what I wrote has to stay there because it's true, that's what happened. In this case, you say, oh, I guess we don't like that, okay, and then you just go delete, and then it deletes, you know.
See, what Don don't realize, Chris, is this. I mean, to some, they look at it, Don Farmer, and then with Chris Curl, and they're looking at, you know, well, Chris is the one that's yanking all the chain. Don is the front end.
Well, that's not accurate. He's the magic fingers there.
I'm just teasing you guys. How much of both of you are in the book?
I would say none, except for the voice. The Deadly News is the characters in the situations. I mean, not that we've, you know, been around a lot of people, got murdered in the newsroom and that kind of thing, but those kinds of situations, it really did come from, you know, decades of experience and that kind of thing. But in terms of being biographical or autobiographical or anything, I mean, then there's not a secret character in there who's Don in disguise at all. It's from his imagination, but it's not a... It's from his vision, but it's not him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's very entertaining.
I was going to say, I think in that line, I think we write the way we think, we think the way we write. I don't, maybe both. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know in what order. So I think in that sense, everything in the book is me or us.
Or
Chris, you know, to some degree or another. But you could then turn it around and say it's really not, because it's certainly nothing biographical about it, nothing autobiographical about it, nothing historical about it.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping it's historic, but not historic.
Yeah.
Well, it's something that could happen anywhere. I mean, we set it in Atlanta, sort of near future, before the next Olympics, because some cities have had more than one Olympics.
Right.
But it could have
been
the World Cup or NASCAR. It really doesn't matter what the event is. It's big, you know, all eyes of the world are on it. And this first murder that you recall happens when a big Hollywood star is murdered at this penthouse party. And then the cops are scrambling to solve the crime, and the politicians don't want the crime to overshadow the games, and the media, and everybody's a big local frenzy to get the story, and, you know, the cable news outlet and all the local stations. So, you know, it goes to the board. You know, the reporters out on the streets. So it, you know, it really is. It could happen anywhere in any city.
Right.
It just happened to pick Atlanta. So it has kind of a, we hope it has a broad enough appeal that it could be, you know, Dallas or Atlanta or any city anywhere where this happens. But it was fun, you know, it was fun.
Yeah. Well, you guys did a fantastic job in terms of being to what I consider now, after hearing you guys are actually the video cameras behind the newsroom.
We're the one they left on. We're the ones they left in the gravel of the Golan Heights.
Yeah, we're left.
Yeah, there you go. There you
camera.
Go. You know, you can say, "Hey, where you going? You know, I'm here.
Yeah. Like, untie me from this palm tree. Get back here."
That's interesting. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading Daily News?
I'd like them to laugh. To appreciate the because there is it's a two-sided coin. There are some great people working in television news, and we want them to appreciate them and not forget that. But but since you never write about the planes that land safely, there's not much point in writing about all the good guys if you can't have any fun with some of the wacky ones, you know.
Yeah.
So I'd like them to get a good laugh out of it and to be really enjoy it. We've been blessed with a lot of nice comments about it, and several people have said, two things people say. One is, are you going to do another book? And we say, yes, we are. And is it going to be a sequel? I say, well, what do you mean? I know what it is. What do you mean? And they said, well, I mean, you're going to have Cassie and Jimmy going to be back again, and what about Brand, and what blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
and we say, well, how much would you pay? No, I'm kidding. And the oddest thing, somebody approached us the other day and asked us if we would donate for a charitable organization here in Southwest Florida. Would we donate the ability to appear in our next novel?
Yeah.
In other words,
yeah.
if you wanted to donate some money to this cause,
there could be a Johnny Tan in the
Johnny
novel.
Tan, or unless you wanted to use a different name, in the book. You see, and I thought, why didn't we think of this first?
Except the money goes to charity, Don.
The money goes to charity. Oh, darn.
And then his idea, Don's idea, was that if the person who is buying this at, say, like a silent auction or something, a charity event, they can pay more if they want to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
right.
If they're going to be a villain, it costs more for the...
Hey, there you go. That's the outline right there. That's it.
Yeah.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, first of all, the book is at most independent bookstores in the country. We love independent bookstores.
Ask for Deadly News.
Ask for Deadly News, and if they don't have it on the shelf, they can order it from the publisher, Headline Books, or you can call the publisher directly, Headline Books. And it's everywhere. Anyway, it's also on Amazon, and you can buy the hardback or the softback or Kindle
or Nook.
Yeah.
And it's also in Barnes and Noble stores. I'm not sure it's in all of them, but it's in some.
It can be ordered anywhere at any bookstore.
Right.
Can order it because it's published by a mainline publisher. So. Yeah, it's available where all fine books are available.
And we do go door-to-door if prompted. So.
No, Chris would be on the driver's side. Say, Don, knock on that door, will you?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Exactly.
That sounds fantastic. Now, you guys are still writing, if I'm not mistaken, correct, columns and so forth? Tell us a little bit about that if you still are doing
that. After we retired from daily television, we were already writing a couple of columns for small papers, but really good papers, one in Atlanta and one here in Southwest Florida. And we've been continued that for 10, 12 years or more. And that's a pleasure to do because it's sort of like a blog. I mean, I've been doing this since before there were blogs, but everybody needs a way to express themselves. Everybody needs an outlet.
Beyond letters to the editor.
and so we enjoy doing that. We've taken a hiatus a little bit because of having just done the book, but we're going to continue to do that. And that's fun because we can write about things that involve the local community, which wouldn't interest anybody else particularly. But that's a good thing because then you can write about your neighbors, and if you do it right, they'll appreciate it. You know, just be careful about that. You know, there's a really funny country song.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorite country songs.
Miranda Lambert.
Miranda Lambert is called "Everybody Dies Famous in a Small Town." Everybody dies famous in a small town, and it's not a sad death story. It's just it's a country song.
Where everybody knows everybody.
Trucks and moms and trains and but it's true. We live in a small city here in South Florida, and we know a lot of people, and the grocery store is 10 blocks away. The point is that you can write about local things that nobody else would care about, but it adds credence and fun and meaning to the life in a small town because it is very special. Not only in this town, but small towns in general, I think, have great personality that often is never gets out.
Very true.
So that's another pleasure. Yeah.
So we enjoy doing that. That was fun. But the book, I think Don really had a great time writing it, and I had a fun time helping. And it was kind of a thrill, Johnny, to see when the first box of books came.
Yeah.
Actually look at it and see it. It was really fun.
Right.
And it was fun. There's been a really good reaction. Mm-hmm. Yours is the best review yet by far, but good reaction from people who enjoyed it, just enjoyed the read, and that's the important thing.
And they can go to our website for the book called deadlynewsthriller.com, and you can see some of the blurbs or the nice comments from other people in the business and
see pictures of us over the decades.
Yeah.
It's called Hairstyles on Parade.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for individuals who aspire to build a flourishing career in the news industry in today's market?
Think again. No, I'm kidding. No, I would say, first of all, you've got to have a good background and a solid foundation in how to write. And I don't mean how to write lyrically or professionally, but how grammar and spelling. I know spell check, but
vocabulary.
It's not...
Vocabulary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the language. The language is so important. It is still, I guess, the most predominant language of business and industry in the world and maybe other things too. And I would tell every youngster out of college or high school, if you can, and I realize a lot of people can't, if you have the means or a way to go see a little bit of the world before you take that first job or that second job, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the most educational thing you can do. Go see how somebody else lives and the way you do that. And because that's so important, because if you're afraid of somebody or prejudiced against somebody or bigoted about somebody, that usually indicates fear or ignorance. And ignorance meaning not ugly ignorance, but just lack of information, lack of knowledge.
Right.
And if you can go meet somebody and talk to them and get to know them a little bit, those barriers start to fall away. I'd sound like Pollyanna here, but it's generally true, it'll last you forever.
It is true, but on a practical level, young people go to, whether it's in college or junior college or even in high school, they'll take a communications or a media course.
Right.
Media theory or something. Well, what they should be taking is a history course, an economics course.
Mm-hmm.
They should be taking grammar. Just grammar. It's amazing how it's just mangled.
It's easier
to tell a story with good tools. And if the tools are vocabulary and grammar, you're going to tell a better story, and then you'll do better at your job. So that's just practically take courses which will teach you something, like I said, history and economics, that kind of thing. Don't take yet another theory in why, Roger Mudd was important. you know, that's not going to get you anywhere.
And I would add one more thing. Go easy on piercings. Be very selective what you pierce. If you want to get a job in America or most of the Western world, be easy on the piercing. Yeah. And the last advice I would have is eat dessert first.
Now, that's probably one from your recipes from my mother's kitchen, right? That's probably
from my mama's kitchen, yes.
Yeah, that's probably your first recipe.
Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite all-time bromide saying, helpful hint?
I think ultimately they have to be authentic. They have to be very humble. And, of course, ultimately speaking from the heart. And all these are pretty much what you have covered in the sense of how do you acquire this? You acquire this by going out there and meeting people and traveling because we are in the global economy now. Chris had mentioned about learning economics, learning history, because history repeats itself, whether you like it or not. And sometimes it's sad that when we forget, then it has to repeat itself, and we go through all the sorrow and the pain and everything else to, guess what, teach us a lesson.
Right. Yeah, all new generation gets to learn anew, right?
Precisely. On a personal note, can you share with us the secret of being happily married for 41 years?
You want a glib answer or a serious answer?
I'll give you my answer. My answer is that we decided a long time ago that if you have two cars, two bathrooms and a microwave oven, you are good to go. But I think, anyway, Don, you can tell.
I would say in terms of personal relationships, with spouses or friends or partners, anybody you care about, try to count to 10 before you answer or before you react, because most things can be smoothed over or at least the lessened impact if you don't react quickly and jump to something, you know. Just be careful because, first of all, you may have heard it incorrectly. Secondly, you may be impaired by lack of sleep or something. And just be careful. And sometimes the best answer, and my best one of all time that I tell my son all the time because he's in the business, same business, it's not always good enough just to be right.
Yeah.
Sometimes being right is not enough. And, and that's really important.
Wonderful, wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning? And both of you all have a shot at giving each a recipe for living.
Don't assume you're invulnerable, but act like it. I mean, I don't mean act like it. I mean play like it. Play like you're going to live forever, but. I'm saying it wrong. Play like you're going to live forever, and then try really hard to, knowing you're not going to. So make the best of it. That's really lame.
Live like
you can't let us end on this lame little silly thing.
I would just say that, like you said, you used the word authentic. I wouldn't have used that, but I'm going to use it from now on because it's a better word than mine. But if you go through life, and if you at the end of the day sort of feel that you haven't really been mean to anybody or done anything.
Yeah.
Wrong with the small W, you know, like a wrong, like you robbed a bank, but, you know, the little slights that people do or that you were nice to somebody who you didn't, maybe you went out of your way to speak to some lady in old lady in a wheelchair or something, you know, most people just walk right by. And I know that because I've been to a lot of hospitals recently with for different reasons, and I just see a lot of people passed by because they're not standing up walking around. I don't know, just by the end of the day, if you can say, well, I didn't do anything bad, and I did some nice things, and what I did was okay. You know, at least that's a start. You know, if you're trying to be authentic and helpful and not be mean to people, I guess.
Be nice.
Yes, be nice.
I like that. I like that. That's a good recipe to remember because sometimes we don't need all this lengthy stuff. If we just be mindful, be nice, that's all it takes.
Well, you're very kind to be nice to me like that. I was supposed to come up with some beautiful,
Chris, I hope Johnny doesn't consider this past hour an hour he'll never get back.
He's talking to his radio engineer, and he's saying, delete, erase that hour.
Don't bother to record this last 30 minutes.
This will never see air.
No, not at all. I think in the end, you two have been very authentic. Y'all have been very humble.
And nice.
There you go. At night. And speaking from the heart. And I think we can't ask for anything more than that. I think that's what it's all about, being yourself. And that's
well,
what
it's a pleasure to meet
it's all about.
Your skill level at doing interviews is impressive, I must say. Really
Wow,
impressive.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for the great recipes for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Amy Newmark, the publisher and editor-in-chief for Chicken Soup for the Soul. Amy and I will be discussing their latest edition, Living with Alzheimer's and Other Dementias, 101 Stories of Caregiving, Coping, and Compassion. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Don and Chris, it has been a true pleasure for me. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
For us too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.